but it fascinated me. He said that the name of this piece is Shahrzad, composed by Nikolai Andreevich Rimsky-Korsakov. I will tell you how he was inspired to compose it. He said, that was my turning point that led me into the fantasy world of beauty and art. Certainly, it left an imprint on my subconscious, and as time elapsed, I became more interested until I bought a Super 8 camera from Germany to make family films. Later, my younger brother, Murtaza Karimi, and I started making amateur projects. At some point, I was drawn to Jean-Paul Sartre and his famous existentialism. That's when I realized I was interested in cinema, but my family was religious and they were reluctant about cinema, at least the cinema of the time. Then, because I had decided to study architecture, I went to Austria and got my diploma there. One day, my visual arts professor asked me, "What were you involved in before?" I recounted the entire story about those amateur projects, and he just said, "Resume your career in cinema." After graduating with a degree in architecture, I went to Professor Wilfon, one of my great visual arts professors. That moment marked the beginning of my passion for documentary cinema, and I felt that this is part of me. Since then, with the help of my compassionate professors, I started making documentary films. These films, with their special features, paved the way for financial support from the Academy and the Ministry of Culture and Arts for my films. But this has been 0 point for me all of these years. What is a documentary? This question has always been in the back of my mind, and I keep wondering about it.
That is a very interesting comment because it brings me to my next question. What does documentary cinema mean to you?
Documentary cinema has different aspects, and there are questions like, why documentary? Why should we make documentaries? And why shouldn't we? I think the definition of a documentary is blurred sometimes. This arises from different types of documentaries, each of which has its own unique style. For example, expository, observational, advertorial, and so on, depending on how we want to tell a story. I believe from the very beginning of my career that I don't want to ask any questions of people or society. I need to believe in something. I thought to myself, I can feel the pain inside me and question whether I truly want to do this or not. If I do, I'll go ahead with it. Investigation is a key element that I consider so important, and it's the first step to begin my work. Investigation in documentary cinema means having a pantry. This is how it works. Avoid speaking with taking your emotions into account and investigate with thoughtful attention. After you're done, you have a clear vision of your pantry. For example, you know there's little or no oil in your pantry. Then you should analyze the things you have, and based on that, you could figure out the structure. Structure is a step that fills my heart with ambiguity. When I encounter a subject, my mind is full of disorderly questions that have nothing to do with stereotypical ones. I start a conversation with a subject to find out what we have in common and what we must share. This has been successfully applied to my work. The pre-production phase of my work has been long because, for me, documentary begins with investigation, which is the fundamental basis of a film.
There is a question here. You know, you mentioned that you do not start with focused questions in order to form your idea of your subject and your documentary. But how do you focus those questions? How do you get to from general questions to specific ones?
In filmmaking, there are flat lighting and ambient lighting methods, and it is the same in investigation. Using different approaches is sometimes necessary. After completing a thorough analysis, I explain to both the cameraman and the subject the steps we should take to achieve the objective I have set. This way, we move closer to reality. The subject shouldn't feel like they're being interrogated during the interview. The documentary about Murtaza Momayez, the father of Iran's graphic art, which was of great importance during that period, is a good example of this. Mr. Akbar Saderi, Mr. Aydin Aghdashloo, and many others were willing to participate in the interview because it didn't feel like an interview and they were relaxed in the settings. Investigation is the first step I take before accepting any offer. In most cases, it doesn't fit me
or is beyond my ability, so I just refuse the offer. Besides, I've always taken full responsibility for any mistakes in the production process. As documentaries deal with facts and history, you can't just walk away from them.
Thank you again, Mr. Azar Karimi. We'll be back with you shortly. The thing is, you just mentioned that you have very long pre-production for your films, but at the same time, you need to be able to afford that. You know, financing documentaries is one of the most difficult tasks for filmmakers, especially young filmmakers know that very well, and maybe they can use your advice on that. How do you finance documentaries?
مشکل من دارم. همین الان که با شما صحبت میکنم.
Making a documentary is difficult, especially when it comes to funding. It is challenging to provide a budget for documentary cinema, whether in Iran or other countries. For example, in Austria, like Iran, they have never spent much money on documentaries due to historical and cultural preferences. The films showcased in film festivals are produced through the cooperation of multiple NGOs, that's non-governmental organizations. So far, my company has made 56 documentaries about the legends of Iran with excellent young directors rather than senior ones. They faced all the tough times with everything they had. I felt ashamed at some points and asked the producer to help them with a little financial support so they could do their best. They have the potential to do an extraordinary job, but the small budget makes it a Herculean task. Sometimes, one of them asks me about his script, and I found out he really wants to put his whole life into it. In recent years, the documentary cinema of Iran is on the rise and has witnessed great efforts, resulting in many good films.
That was very interesting. Let us your documentary, The Unfinished Road. What is so interesting about this work in particular is how close you get to your main characters. It's not like they are talking to just a camera. They're talking to a friend. They confide in you. How do you achieve that in your films?
There's a principle, especially in documentary cinema, that you shouldn't make a puppet out of your interviewee. People shouldn't feel that they've been treated like puppets. The point is not to misuse the interviewee to achieve whatever is on your mind. One of my professors said that mortality is one of the characteristics of a documentary maker. Don't fool yourself, no matter how famous you become, if it is all because of the controversy you have created by misusing the interviewee and treating them like a puppet, you are a failure. You have lost both your own respect and the respect of the interviewee. There comes a time when both the documentary maker and the interviewee should feel that they are of the same mind, whether on screen or off camera. If you feel that the interviewee is emotionally attached to you and kind of obsessed with you, and it could lead to potential abuse, cut it off. This is what two of my great professors advised me in my youth, and they emphasize keeping the trust.
Same time, I want to talk about a little bit about the strategy of your filmmaking. Your films are not just works of art. They usually have a strategic side to them as well. It's not just about expressing yourself in your films. You kind of set the tone. You lead the way and inspire younger filmmakers. How does that happen?
Recently, it's been said in Iran that if you want to make a fantastic film, you should simulate it. What does simulation mean? I've never done this in my work. The matter is, if you plan every aspect of a scenario so well that it fascinates the subject, they will voluntarily and passionately participate. In fact, you should mirror their mind rather than simulating the situation And this is a very delicate matter. Take the example of Asghar Qanchi's documentary, in which I got to know everything about his life. He was an illiterate blacksmith, and I began uncovering the realities of his life when I accompanied him through the different garages where he worked. Despite being illiterate, he managed to achieve success, and these garages were his space. Once, there was a bunch of automobiles in the garage, but I told them to move them so we could have an empty space. Why did I do that, and what does it have to do with Qanchi? When you understand the content, you know how to provide the space that your subject needs. Novice filmmakers ignore this approach and aim to show a handwritten something or film the subject from the back. That's okay, but it doesn't make you an author or a narrator. Take this for granted. Don't start the work until you've reached that level, because it will be very time-consuming and difficult to handle. Focusing on the subject is the first step. Every sentence that each character has to say can open new doors for you and improve your work. No one expects a complicated documentary when it is published. They just cheer you up when it is smooth and they can relate. There are three major elements in documentary making. Do not distort the facts, don't lie, and don't say everything at hand. These three elements validate your words in everyday life. The audience is not determined to analyze this, but they will feel connected unconsciously.
That was very interesting. Your films are mostly character-driven. We see a full range of characters in your films. We see doctors, world leaders, war heroes, even entrepreneurs. How do you pick your characters? I'm really curious to know, what is your policy when it comes to picking the right subject for your film?
As I mentioned before, investigation plays a major role. Now I will explain how we can incorporate it into the film. Personology is crucial as you get closer to the subject, allowing you to observe both the good and bad sides of his personality. During my investigation, and later in the scenario, I became involved with his personality. I knew his favorite spot, so while we were producing the film, I asked him to sit there. He was pleased and mentioned that he had many memories of that place. Half of my questions were answered even before asking them. This requires a deep understanding of psychology and personology to recognize that this spot in his yard or garage has been his hangout for 20 years, where he eats lunch and takes breaks. This is where documentary filmmaking reaches its high quality. Despite having other good spots to capture the film in the house, you know this is the subject's safe zone where he feels comfortable and at ease. This is why I told the filmmakers that half my questions were already answered. This understanding derives from getting closer to his personality, but we both know there is a line that neither of us should cross if we want to keep this interview respectful. Sometimes it has happened that subjects voluntarily bring up new topics and they turned out to be good ones. There was a lady, an important figure, whom we interviewed. I expressed my appreciation and apologized for taking her time afterward. She said, "Don't mention it at all. Nobody is waiting for me at home. I'm all alone. I'm happy to be here." This dialogue wasn't in my scenario, but I told my assistant that we needed to end the film with her sentence, "Nobody is waiting for me at home, I'm all alone." When you find the true path, other unexpected things will happen naturally as the subject wants to make it easier for himself. This is the result of solid trust. Being a documentary filmmaker is a difficult job, as said by Joseph Meyer, the German director who emphasized three important principles in the documentary cinema: determination, patience, and execution. Additionally, there's a belief, especially in documentary cinema, that you shouldn't treat the subject as a puppet. People shouldn't feel that they have been treated like puppets or misused. Some people call it morality, and one of my professors said it's one of the characteristics of a documentary maker. Respect yourself and your subject. If you feel he is emotionally attached to the film, and it could lead to potential abuse, take a step back and maintain the trust. Don't take any chances in ruining that trust.
That was indeed interesting, Mr. Azhar Karimi. Stay with us, we'll be back shortly. That is very interesting. I want to talk a little bit about one of your most important films to date, The Lady Cuts of Iran. You know, most of the film was done posthumously. Of course, the entire thing, because you did not have access to your subject, to your main character. How can you achieve something like that? Because at the same time, you managed to keep it very personal, despite the fact that you did not have access to the live person, to the live human being in front of you. How did you decide to use the right archival material to get to this point, to create something that talks to the audience?
To be honest, I only knew her name, Batul. The producers chose me from among many directors, and they provided me with 18 books to gain information about the subject. I read all but two of them. I told them I wouldn't sign any contracts until I had thoroughly investigated the matter. And after my investigation, I felt ready to begin. There were some disputes initially, and we realized that we were on the wrong track. This wasn't what it was supposed to be, so we started again. The production progressed rapidly. However, the investigation took about a year and a few months. Through conversations with those who were close to her, I realized she was quite an important figure. The imam and his wife came from two completely different backgrounds. She was from a Qajar family, while Imam came from a religious background and was a 27-year-old student. She traveled by carriage, accompanied by servants, could speak French, and wore a new set of clothes whenever she bathed.
کودکیم به شادمانی می‌گذشت بدون هیچ نگرانی و دغدغه‌ای که هرچه می‌خواستم مهیا بود. کفش‌های مارکدار به قیمت 6 تومان، معلم سرخانه برای یادگیری فرانسه. آقا زبی که هر جا که می رفتم آماده بود تا خواسته هایم را برآورده کند و سلطنت بیگم که تنها کارش این بود که برایم چای بریزد و قربان صدقه هم برود.
من احساس کردم
My goal in producing this film was to show their life of happiness and love despite their differences. She wasn't revolutionary, but he was, which inspired me to make the documentary The Grand Lady of Iran. Her grandson never criticized my decisions to add or remove content. I realized they were an intellectual family, making my investigation particularly relevant. I chose the room. Up to that moment, no one had seen the inner quarters of Imam's house for interviewing his daughter, but returned to Iran after 20 years. This room was her place of rest, and I asked her to sit on her mother's bed. She considered it an insult, but I convinced her by saying I knew what I was doing. She sat on the bed and said this was the place where they unburdened themselves and talked to each other. As I told everyone, this was their cherished place. All the family members collaborated with me and did their best to help me, which was due to their trust in me, placing more responsibility on my shoulders. Without a doubt, the great lady of Iran didn't like Qom, but out of love for her husband, she tolerated it. She loved and respected her husband, yet she remained independent. I told her grandson that I wanted to show this. I didn't want to idolize or vilify her. This wasn't an expository documentary. As a director, I must control my emotions because sometimes moving away from emotions is all you need.
It was really impressive. Thank you so much for giving us this pleasure and honor.
همینطور من تشکر میکنم. خداحافظی میکنم.
Until I see you again. Thank you so much. This was another episode of Sob. Please stay with us. Until next time, it's goodbye from me, Bahman Urayi.
WRIB English Radio presents Viewpoints.
Viewpoints.
With the presence of different scholars.
The presence of different scholars. IRIB English Radio.
Bismillah ar-Rahman ar-Rahim. Palestine isn't just a news headline. It's a reality millions of people live every day. Quds Day reminds us that this struggle isn't just about one land or one people. It's about justice for everyone. With all the challenges, from occupation to political pressure, many wonder, what's the real path forward? Can anything actually change? Let's have an open and honest conversation about what's happening, what resistance really mean, and how we can make a difference. Welcome, everyone, to your program, The Viewpoint from IRIB English Radio. This is your humble host, Sayyid Ali, and here I am with dear brothers in faith, dear brother Sayyid Zain. Assalamu alaikum, dear brother.
Wa alaikum salam wa rahmatullah.
Good to have you here. And dear brother Sheikh Danish, really good to have you here, brother.
Thank you.
We have been seeing heroic acts from Palestinian people, dear Sayyid. So we've been seeing some apocalyptic scenes during this huge, amazing resistance of Palestinian people. Why they are like that? Why they are so strong in their beliefs, and they insist on, you know, keep doing resistance. Mm-hmm. What do you think?
So definitely, as Sheikh has pointed out, it couldn't have been. It's not possible without Allah's help. Mm. And even when you see that, you know, a lot of times when they're going through difficulties, they're remembering Allah, they're citing the verses of Allah. And you know, during resistance itself, they are reciting these verses. So definitely, that's the case. That Allah's help has been there for them. But it is truly, truly amazing, as you said, and it's mind baffling, right? That people are able to do this. That, you know, the way that they have been bombed, the way that they have been killed, the way that, you know, the basic necessities of life have been, you know, deprived. They have been deprived of them.
Yeah.
And even after that, they are so resilient. Even after that, they are fighting back. Even after that, they are, you know, they're still there, and they have that will to do this. It's truly amazing. I think for us to kind of not having experienced that, I don't even think we can imagine what that would be like.
Yeah.
And inshallah, you know, like if us, if we're to be in those kind of situations, we pray to Allah that we are able to hold on to our faith and closeness to Allah subhanahu wa ta'ala in the same way that they have been able to do it. It's truly, truly amazing.
I have seen some of these images during this formidable war, like movies. It's like so surrealistic for me. I couldn't even believe what I'm seeing in front of my eyes. And I guess resistance should definitely pays off at some points, inshallah.
So with regards to the videos as well, unfortunately, I didn't have the heart to keep watching them as they were coming. They were just so, and these people are living through it.
Yeah,
it's truly amazing that they were able to, you know, bear that. But one point I would say over here for, you know, the listeners, you know, in different countries, is that there is an effort to minimize, put to the side, the suffering of the Palestinian people, to not concentrate on it, to not let these videos reach the people.
Mm-hmm.
But anybody who has an open heart and open eyes, they would see the extent of the suffering, right? That the true, because, you know, these a lot of these, you know, news agencies, they try to cover it up. They say that, okay, you know, it's lies. The Palestinians are making up these numbers of dead people. It's for the Palestinians making up. But really, I think if somebody is honest to themselves and goes and does research of what has happened, they would come to this conclusion that what has happened is truly, truly, truly horrific.
Yeah.
There's a reason why, you know, Trump is, you know, the president is saying that, you know, in a way that a natural disaster came and all these houses got destroyed. No, Israelis destroyed them. They destroyed them on purpose, and they killed people on purpose. And I think people have to open their eyes and look at this and realize this.
And they kept doing it while the whole world was saying, stop it, enough is enough. And they just kept doing it, and on purpose. It was like unbelievable.
And they were proud of it. They were proud of bombarding these ordinary houses, hospitals. They did it on purpose. And the first hospital that they hit, they said it was a mistake. But then it continued until every hospital that was functioning got destroyed in the process.
Yeah. So, Sheikh Danish, the U.S. and Israel have long sought control over Gaza. What are the biggest obstacles to their plans? And what strategies have proven successful in countering their influence, in your opinion?
Yes, so the biggest obstacle has been the will of the Palestinian people. And we have seen this over a period of time, that although the Palestinians are a small group of people when we compare it with the global help that is reaching the Zionist entity, but the Zionists are invaders, or they operate in that territory with a colonial mindset. So they can only go to a certain distance, right? Yeah. Although there, some of them are religiously motivated, and therefore they might be able to sacrifice more, but a majority of these people, what has been their history? They have been collected together from different parts of the world with the promise that you are going to a land which is, of course, in their words, promised land, but you will get a good house, you will have a good life there, you will have no troubles. And a very rosy picture is painted for them.
Remind me of the Crucified Wars when the Pope said, yeah.
Yes. And so when they come to realize the reality of the suffering they're inflicting on the Palestinian people, and this 16-month period was also a very good lesson for the Israeli public, that all is not rosy and hunky-dory in the land that was promised to you by these politicians.
Yeah.
But rather, the Palestinians are willing to fight, they are willing to sacrifice, and they are willing to sacrifice 10 times or even 100 times more than you people, because you are not natives of this land. All of you have passports to and you have second nationalities, you have dual nationalities. At the very drop of a hat, you are willing to fly out of these territories and go back to your native countries or wherever you came from. And so this willingness to fight for your land, and this ability of these people to leave this land and not to sacrifice for it, is the basic defining thing, in my opinion, that even with the help of so many foreign powers and without any restrictions, and even some of the Muslim rulers are colluding with the Zionist entity. We see that even Turkey, which is called the center of this land, it had a continuous supply of oil that was reaching the Zionist
oil
entity.
Metal, so
yes.
Many things.
And so we see that this is like backstabbing your Muslim brothers, and it is not possible that you say that you are believing in the Muslim Ummah and nation, and you keep supplying the Zionist entity at a time when they are committing genocide. So all of these things, the willingness of the Palestinian people to fight for their cause, is the basic thing and the defining thing that is there.
Thank you so much, dear brother Sayyid Zain. From boycotts to social media activism, people around the world have found ways to stand with Palestine. In your view, what are the most powerful ways that the individual can, you know, raise awareness and make a real difference?
So I think the a very important thing that needs to be done is spreading awareness, is making sure that the truth reaches everyone, because there is a very strong push to have the truth not reach the people.
But some people would argue against it by saying that, you know, the videos, the clips are out there, and people can, you know, take and see all the footage regarding the wars and Palestinian situation. They just don't want to jeopardize their, you know, job situation, job careers, whatever they have.
So I don't think everyone is in that boat.
Huh.
There are certain people like that, but it's just the control over the media that some of these corporations and some of these politicians and the power has. That they're able to, you know, the term is used, manufacture consent, right? That even though, yes, the truth is there if somebody goes and looks for it, but because they're bombarded so much with falsehood that they believe in it.
Yeah.
They're like, these, you know, everyone who's, you know, on the news, they can't be lying, but they are lying, right?
Yeah.
So the truth has to be made clear.
It neutralize the effect of it, the effect of the truth.
Right. So basically, you know, try to get people away from the, what's it called? The
like mainstream
corporate media. Yeah, mainstream corporate media. Try to get people away from mainstream corporate media. Try to get them to these alternative news sources, more honest news sources. Try to get them in touch with, you know, like the actual footage that's been coming out from Palestine. So I think that's very, very important, that the truth has to be made clear and spread. That if this truth is so strong and so potent, that if it, you know, it reaches a normal person, it wakens something in them. that, you know, this amount of suffering, this amount of, you know, the genocide that's happening, you know, no, I have to do something about it. And that is the natural response of somebody who does learn to, you know, gets to learn this truth, right? There is something within us human beings that when we see injustice, especially to this extent, that something awakens within us.
You want to do something about it.
Yes. So a lot of people are like that. Yes, there are people who are, you know, who suppress that and who say that no, make excuses for it. And they are, you know, truly different grades of it. But somebody like, you know, the president of the United States, he knows what's going on.
Yeah.
But he's truly evil, right? So, you know, there are people like that. But generally people, you know, when they're faced with the truth, something awakens in them. And I think that is very, very important to spread the truth.
Dear brother Sheikh Danesh, what would be a free and independent Palestine look like, and how would the world be different without Zionism?
True. So there's something that is called the one-state solution that is presented by even some of the Palestinians. And the Islamic Republic also has put forward the one-state solution. And in this one-state solution, basically the solution that is presented is that Palestine could become a place where Muslims and Jews and Christians could live in harmony. But it is for the Palestinian people, the original representatives of that land.
Is it like something we have in Lebanon or in Iraq? Or?
Yes. Mm-hmm. Before the Zionist entity as well, people from all faiths and traditions were living in the Jewish, Palestinian land. And we had Christians, we had Jews, and we had Muslims living side by side. It was with the arrival of the colonial project of Zionism that Muslims were forced out of their land. The Christians as well were forced out from their lands. And these were the original people, and they had to migrate to different countries, to Jordan, to Lebanon, to Syria, and throughout the world, Egypt as well. So what we have as a solution is that for the Palestinian people to decide for themselves, and if they want to allow the people who have migrated after 1948 to these territories to live side by side with them, they have to live with the concept of one person, one vote. And if these people agree to it, because many of them will leave. What will happen is that because they saw Palestine as an ideal state for the Jews from all over the world, they thought that this is a state where we are only allowed to have the most rights and everybody else is a second-grade citizen. But no, everybody will have equal status in front of law. It could be a land like South Africa. For example, apartheid was the practice in South Africa in which whites had superiority in every term over the blacks or the African natives of that land. But what happened was that with the passage of
Nelson Mandela.
Yes, Nelson Mandela and the movement of liberation of South Africa, this apartheid regime was demonized and it was boycotted by the entire world, and it gave way for more equal rights for the rest of them. So something along those lines is possible, but it is for the Palestinian people to decide how to proceed from here. But what we as the global community want to stress is that this apartheid regime is not going to survive. Not only it is illegal, it is also impractical that something like that can survive over the long run, because the people are committing genocide, they are committing violence against the local people, and this is something that is going to die its natural death, inshallah.
Inshallah. Thank you so much. The last question for dear Sayyid, and I do, you know, demand for a brief answer. So with Gaza devastated and most of the Palestine is still occupied, I think like 80% of it, is there still hope for a free and independent future?
Mm-hmm. So I would say there's more hope now than ever before.
How come?
Because the global population has woken up to some extent to what is happening. Because the resistance is alive. The resistance is, yes, you know, there's a lot of houses that are destroyed, but the resistance is still there. The people's will is still strong and perhaps even stronger than before. People throughout the world realize what the Zionist regime is its reality. It's, you know, shown it to us clearly, right? So I think there is more hope now than ever before. And inshallah, you know, if the believers, if the people of the world, they keep resisting, they keep, you know, doing what needs to be done, then, you know, this state, the illegal state, the Zionist state won't survive.
Thank you so much, inshallah. Despite the devastation, history has shown that resilience and justice can prevail as long as there is faith, unity, and commitment to truth. Hope for a free Palestine remains alive. Thank you for listening, dear audience. Till another episode. Wassalamu alaikum wa rahmatullah.
Shining bright, you came to us with a heart so full of love, and you showed that you're the one who cares the most, and to us you've always been so close. Everyone will say, please save me, accept our يقولها لنا يوم القيامة أمتي أمتي يقولها شفاعة أنا لها أنا لها
pieces of bread from me, and your soul will never be broken. And if I am your haven, you will never be homeless. One whose cloak is me will never be naked. And one whose resort is me will never be destitute. God is above all powers. IRIB English Radio.
Rabbana, Rabbana.
Ask the followers of the remembrance if ye know not.
Rabbana, Rabbana, ya Rabbana, ya Rabbana, ya Hayyu wa ya Qayyum, nawwir qalbana.
You are listening to the program The Key on Iran Radio with Sheikh Shiraz, a graduate of Islamic Seminary of Qom.
Bismillahir Rahmanir Rahim. Welcome to our program, The Key, here at IRIB English Radio. Today on The Key, we're going to be examining a question which is related to the month that we are currently in. I'm speaking, of course, the month of Ramadan. As you know, the month of Ramadan is a very significant month. It's a very important month. In fact, in some hadiths, it's been related that if the servant was to fathom the worth of Ramadan, he would wish that Ramadan lasted the whole year. This shows us how important and significant it is. But the question we want to ask is, what exactly is the significance of the month of Ramadan? Why is it important? And in order to respond to and answer this question, we can take inspiration from the hadith, which have been passed down to us from the infallibles. By way of example, in one beautiful hadith, it's been narrated that the Prophet said, sallallahu alayhi wa sallam, "He who experiences the month of Ramadan and remains unforgiven has indeed been distanced by Allah." Oh, so that, I guess, implies that the chances of being forgiven in the month of Ramadan are more than in other months. You're more likely to be forgiven by God for your sins in the month of Ramadan than you are in other months. In a similar tradition, it's been narrated that the Holy Prophet Muhammad sallallahu alayhi wa alihi wasallam said, "If a person remains unforgiven in the month of Ramadan, then what other month is there left for him to be forgiven in?" Meaning, if a person doesn't sin, he cannot be forgiven in this month, there's less chance that he will be forgiven in other months. And another significant aspect of the month of Ramadan is that, as you know, in this month we have been advised to fast. This is the only month in which fasting has been made obligatory on us, obviously, for this reason. A lot of us are forced to do good, and, the chances of us are being forgiven are greater. In a beautiful hadith, it's been narrated that Imam Sadiq alayhi salam said the following in his advice to his children, heralding the advent of the month of Ramadan. He said, "Exert yourselves in doing good deeds, for verily in this month a sustenance is apportioned, lifespans are destined, the names of Allah's select servants who wish to strive towards him are recorded down. And in this month is a night wherein the good deeds performed equal the deeds of 1,000 months. Right? So this is a nice hadith in that the Imam mentioned a lot of significant aspects of this month. He mentioned the fact that in this month our sustenance, our risk is decreed, our lifespans are destined, and our names are selected for who will be the good servants of God. And also in this month there's a night, implying Laylatul Qadr, the night of ordainment, when the good deeds we perform in that night are equal to the good deeds of 1,000 months. These are some of the significant aspects of the month of Ramadan and why it's so important. Thank you for joining us here on The Key. We were looking at the significance of the month of Ramadan in the light of the hadith. Until next time, wassalamu alaikum wa rahmatullahi wa barakatuh.
You just listened to the program The Key on Iran Radio with Sheikh Shiraz, a graduate of Islamic Seminary of Qom.
You can also send your questions to englishradio@irib.ir.
Qom Province, with an area of nearly 15,000 square kilometers, occupying less than 1% of the entire territory of the Islamic Republic of Iran. The province is linked to Tehran Province in the north, to Save, Tafresh, Ashtian, and Dilijan in Markazi Province in the south. It lies to the southeast of Isfahan, and from the east to Cavier Valley and Namak Lake. About one-fifth of the province is covered with mountains and foothills, with the remaining four-fifths a large valley or basin. The holy city of Qom is situated in the center of the province, close to the surrounding towns of Salafjagan, Khalajistan, Kahak, and Jafariya. Given its historic structures, discoveries of artifacts, and the recordings of historical documents, Qom was a reputable and relatively large city in the pre-Islamic era. When Islam was introduced to Iran, Qom developed rapidly and became semi-autonomous during the sovereign reign of the Bani Umayyad and Bani Abbas caliphates. Qom is home to the heavenly court, the historic mausoleum, and shrine of Hazrat Ma'sumeh. Also known as Fatimeh Ma'sumeh, the daughter of Imam Musa Kazim, the seventh Imam of Shia Islam. Hazrat Ma'sumeh is revered by Muslims worldwide, and so her resting place being in Qom lifted the dignity and status of the city and conferred religious significance upon it. Among the other notable tourist attractions in the province are the holy Jamkaran Mosque and more than 400 other Imamzades, offspring of imams, shrines, seminaries, theological schools, historically important mosques such as Friday, Imam Hassan, Babul Jannah, and Raf'at, educational and international institutes, and Qomrud Lake. When the 7th Abbasid Caliph Ma'mun invited Imam Reza to Marv, Hazrat Ma'sumeh moved to Iran in the company of a number of Shia Muslims to meet with and join Imam Reza. But just outside Qom, she was taken ill. In her 80s at the time, she was bedridden in Qom for 17 days before she passed away. Her body was buried in a well-respected place in the city of Bagh Babylon. Today, Bagh Babylon is famous because of Hazrat Ma'sumeh's shrine that houses a magnificent monument. This stately edifice is one of the most important religious shrines of the Islamic world. The original shrine was built in the middle of the 3rd century Islam and was expanded substantially between the 4th and 6th centuries when a dome and artwork were added to it. Azam Mosque, located right next to Hazrat Ma'sumeh's mausoleum, is the city's Azam Mosque, known widely as Ayatollah Bujardi's Azam Mosque. It was built in 1918 through the efforts of Sayyid Hossein Tabotabai Bujardi. The architect of this splendid monument was a man named Hossein Lorzadeh. It is classified among the three largest veranda mosques. Its dome stands at 24 meters high. Today, the mosque is the Qom Seminary's most important teaching center. The mosque is now merged with Hazrat Ma'sumeh's shrine. Recently, its dome was adorned with large thin flakes of lusterware, donated and produced under the supervision of Haj Hassan Jaber Ansari. The Tabotabai Mosque, spearheaded by Hujjatul Islam Agha Muhammad Tabotabai, the son of Ayatollah Haj Agha Hussein Qomi, A great mosque with an elevated dome was built adjacent to Hazrat Masume's mausoleum. Famously known as the Tabo Taboi Mosque, it was built between 1981 and 1991. Century Islamic era, Shah Tahmasp Safavi used bricks to build the first sepulcher on the mosque. Sometime later, an additional sepulcher made of transparent white steel was installed around the original sepulcher, and a wooden door was fitted in the northern frontage. In the 13th century Islamic era, Fath Ali Shah Qajar replaced this door with a luxurious golden door. He also upgraded the sepulcher by having it coated with layers of silver and installed on a malachite pillar. With time, the sepulcher lost its radiance, so in the 14th century in Islamic era, it was again renovated. Finally, in 1973, the form of the sepulchers was altered and its height increased. Fath Ali Shah Qajar had the shrine flagstoned with marble. He believed the spiritual gusts around Hazrat Masume's shrine has to step on the best of stones. Atiq Courtyard. In the 10th century in the Islamic era, Shah Begum Khatun, the daughter of Shah Ismail Safavi, built a square-form courtyard with three verandas. Later, Fath Ali Shah had it remodeled into an irregular octagonal shape. This octagonal form is said to have been built on the memorial of Imam Reza Thaman al-Hujjaj, the brother of this holy woman, pointing to the fact that Imam Reza was the 8th Shia Imam. Gradually, the number of verandas in the courtyard increased. At the moment, it has 7 of them, 4 on the south side and 3 on the north. The verandas of the Atiq courtyard are the most famous within this court. They were built on the order of Shah Begum and gilded during the reign of Fath Ali Shah Qajar. They constitute the entrance of the heavenly courtyard.
atop each veranda, a hadith inscription in white thulf is displayed on an azure background. Above it, a myriad of tiles and inscriptions. Imam Khomeini Great Sanctuary. It is one of the greatest architectural feats after the 1979 Islamic Revolution, featuring a multitude of porches, entrances, and other facilities. Balasar Overhead Mosque, it is situated nearby and overhead to Hazrat Masumeh's shrine. That's where it draws its name. In the Safavid period, it served as a motel. Inside the shrine and next to the holy tomb of Hazrat Masumeh, a mausoleum houses the eternal resting places of grand ayatollahs, scholars, and outstanding scientific and religious figures. The largest grouping of revered Muslims anywhere, particularly in the Shia world. Qum is called Darul Aman. Some of the renowned and compassionate scholars buried in the mausoleum here are Allames Tabatabai, Khansari, Golpayegani, and Bahjat. Martyr of love and writing and eminent ideologist Murtaza Mutahhari is also buried here. In the INM mirror courtyard of the Holy Shrine lies the mausoleum of freedom crusader Sheikh Fazlullah Nuri, born in 1843 and killed in 1909. Sheikh Nuri's memorial is symbolic among the liberal crusaders of constitutionalism. The tomb of martyr Ayatollah Dr. Mufatteh. He was born in 1889 and martyred in 1939. The Faizia Theological School was founded in the Middle Ages of Islamic history and is located in Qom next to Hazrat Masumeh Shrine in Astan-e-Muqaddase, Holy Threshold Square. It was registered as a national heritage in 2001.